Thank you, Ratnagosha. I remember Ratnagosha on one of those early retreats, not my first one, giving a talk on Moga City called Nothing to Fear. Nothing to Fear. Suddenly sort of came back to me. So it's a privilege to be here. Very, very nice to be here. I don't get out much. I'm just sitting here just now. I was just listening to the sound of the wind. And perhaps partly because I'm in an unfamiliar shrine room, I just had this moment of imagining myself in a forest, in a dark forest. Very appropriate for a Moga city, with the wind blowing. I can't hear it now, but when we were meditating, it was all around us, and that is a Moga city's element. It felt to me like there was something of his presence. It's not just air that's a Moga city is associated with, it's wind. It's this sort of wind that wakes us up. So it's lovely to see the shrine, and thank you, Anagosha. The world says you have needs, satisfy them. You have as much right as the rich and the mighty. Don't hesitate to satisfy your needs. Expand your needs and demand more. This is the worldly doctrine of today. And they believe that this is freedom. The result for the rich is isolation and suicide. For the poor, envy and murder. So I came across those words. They're from Dostoevsky, is from the Brothers Karamazov. And they're, you know, passionate, stirring words. But I was sort of struck by them when I read them. I was thinking about this talk just earlier today and yesterday, and just struck by the madness of the world. Perhaps particularly at the moment, but probably it's always been mad. It just feels that maybe the madness has broken through some of our sort of veneer of being in a lovely, safe, comfortable, sort of civilized world where everything's on tap. But it isn't like that, is it? It really isn't like that, and probably never has been. But particularly, you know, when I've been looking at the news, and I've had a slightly sort of mixed response to looking at the news, probably you have too, there's a sort of slightly purient fascination that I can sometimes feel at sort of wanting to learn about tragedy and horror. And it doesn't feel completely right and healthy. So I've been sort of working with that. And at the same time, I sort of want to know what's going on as well, in a certain sense. So I don't quite know sometimes when the border's crossed. But thinking a little bit about it, I kind of feel nobody, at least that I've heard on the political spectrum, seems to have very much of an intelligent response, apart from, and I'm talking about the Paris atrocities, apart from we're going to bomb more, and we're going to step up our surveillance of everybody, and we're going to show that we can carry on as normal, which means eating and drinking and shopping more, because that's our Western heritage and freedom to shop. But there doesn't seem to be much analysis beyond that of why this sort of atrocity happens and what it says about our place in the world. There doesn't seem to be much analysis yet. Maybe there will be in time. Nor does there seem to be, as I say, much of an intelligent response apart from more hatred. And of course, understandable though it is to want to defend our values and our safety and Europe is such a wonderfully privileged continent to live in. Understandable though that is, it feels very sort of shallow to sort of just respond in that sort of knee-jerk way. Shallow even from the point of self-interest. I'm not even trying to talk about the Dharma in its more profound sense. Just even from our own self-interest, more violence is going to lead to more violence. And that seems so, so obvious. There's got to be some sort of better option. But then as Buddhists, one of the criticisms that can be levelled against us is a sort of passivity where we can retreat into our own rather comfortable worlds, where we can get together on an evening like this, meditate together, we can manage the stresses and strains of life through our Dharma practice without necessarily trying to have an impact on the world at large. And I don't believe that's a fair criticism. I don't believe that is entirely justified. And yet, I think it's understandable. And it's not enough grains of truth in there for it to be concerning, or it should concern us. It concerns me. Because I think that there are dangers that we face as a Sangha, and more widely as a culture, that aren't to do just with terrorists and bombs and, no matter how horrific those events are, probably statistically, hopefully, it's unlikely that one of us is going to be in a terrorist, directly involved in a terrorist attack. But the dangers that face us, I think, more generally are more insidious. And we live in a culture where we're told that we can just satisfy our own needs, as Dostoevsky says, and that that's the right way to live. And we can become more and more rich and comfortable. And there's no limit to that. And that is the aim of human existence. And the isolation that causes, the unhappiness that causes, the loneliness, the fragmentation, both of society and of the psyche individually, is a real, real danger that's happening now, all the time. It's happening now, and we don't hear that much talked about that. We should be frightened of that, probably more than we should be frightened of a terrorist attack, because we're affected by it. I feel myself affected by it, and I'm trying to go against that trend. So I think to live a meaningful life, to counteract this, we have to act. Amoghā Siddhi is the Buddha that's associated with the active dimension of the enlightened mind. He is the Buddha's active dimension of the Buddha's experience. That's what Amoghā Siddhi is. We sometimes, I guess, talk about these Buddha figures as symbols, but in a way that doesn't really do them justice. Amoghā Siddhi is a active force in conditioned existence. And this is how he's personified, how it's personified. And we have to somehow open up to that active force and let it come through us. And if it comes through us, we will have to act. We will have to act. Let me just read you something that the novelist, the writer William Gass said. Of course there is enough to stir our wonder anywhere. There's enough to love anywhere. If one is strong enough, if one is diligent enough, if one is perceptive, patient, kind enough, whatever it takes. And if we're going to do that, if we're going to love anywhere, be patient, kind, perceptive anywhere, strong anywhere, then we really will have to work. It won't, unless we're very, very naturally spiritually gifted, it's not going to come naturally, it won't come easily. And to live a meaningful life, we're going to have to be prepared to work. I'm partly talking to myself because I have a strong, strong tendency in me, and still feel this after 20 years of practice, to be comfortable and to settle down. I have fantasies of when I stop being chairman, and I'm really happy being chair of the LBC, it's a privilege, but I have fantasies of when I stop being chair, then I'll have lots of long lie-ins and put my feet up and visit lots of art galleries, and that's it. And that'll be me done for this life. That's still there. And then I have this other side of me that needs to live a meaningful life. I want to have a life that feels like I'm doing something that makes a positive contribution in the world. So somebody earlier today was saying to me, do I not get angry at what happened in Paris? Do I not get sort of really stirred up? And I was saying, well, I haven't done. And I think the reason I haven't done is that I feel that I'm trying to live a meaningful life, and I'm trying to do something positive in the world. And what's more, I'm part of a larger community doing that. And then our larger community, the Tree Ratna community, is part of, well, many millions of people, not just Buddhists, who are trying to have a positive impact on the world around them. And of course, we won't make the headlines for that. We're not going to make the headlines. Just to come back to Emodo City, sitting here and sort of imagining myself in this darkened forest. I was trying to sort of imagine Emodo City before me, and actually what that didn't happen, but what did come to mind was the Northern Lights. It was as if there was this mysterious light, and I could just sense this sort of green light flickering in the night sky. And the green of Emodo City is, I think, a bit like that. Sometimes Emodo City's green is talked about as the colour of nature and life and soothing green. And of course it is all of those things. But I really like this image of the Northern Lights flashing, lighting up a night sky. And there's something not very comforting about them, but mysterious. It's not green in that comforting sense. Green light in a night sky is something otherworldly, something mysterious. And that's because Emodo City's action, the action of an enlightened being, isn't comprehensible. It will not meet our ordinary conceptions of what should be happening. Compassionate activity, we call it that, and it trips off the tongue easily, but it's not comprehensible. If we think we've got it, we haven't. And of course that's true of not just Emodo City, but all of the Buddhas. But Emodo City's action is, perhaps it's emphasized that it's mysterious, because it is action in this world, and yet it's not of this world. It's born of something beyond this world. So how do we approach that? That's if there's something beyond our ken, how do we even move towards it, let alone aspire to embody it? And after all, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to embody, well, become even a Emodo City. So at our level, one main way, I guess, that we approach this force that is Emodo City is through going beyond our own selfishness. our self-centeredness that wants to just have what I want and have an easy life, or if not an easy life, then to just work hard, strive, but for me and perhaps those that are most dear to me. Somehow we've got to go beyond that if we're going to be opening up to a force that's greater in the world. But of course that's not enough. It's not enough to be active in the world if we're not already also working on our own minds. If we're not trying to transform our minds, our consciousness, then no amount of activism is going to, in the end, help. That's not to say that it can't have some gain, but in the end, without working on our own greed and our own hatred, we're just going to be part of the problem. We're going to be adding to the problem. And this is, I think, what we're seeing in our culture more and more. I was just reading about a woman in Ireland who said that she and her husband's a Muslim, and they've already been subject to vandalism in the house and attacks, and just this weekend. So if we're not going to work on our own minds, then we think we're doing good, and actually we're just part of the problem. Vision without action is merely a dream. Action without vision just passes the time. Vision with action can change the world. That's Joel Barker. Vision with action can change the world. And without that, it's not enough. So I think one of the things that we can look at is, why are we practicing? What's our motivation for practicing? You know, none of us is probably going to go and live a very harmful life. But what is it that fuels our motivation to meditate, to practice the precepts, to develop friendships? What is it? And I know back at the LBC, and probably speaking for myself to some degree, although not entirely, mostly people come across the Dharma because they want to be happier. And that seems fair enough, doesn't it? It feels sort of self-evidently fine that, yes, we want to be happier. But at some point in our Dharma lives, unless our vision of practicing the Dharma becomes bigger, becomes larger than my well-being, then in a sense the Dharma doesn't work. In a sense, Amoga City's force for good in the world won't work through us. And in another sense, we're just adding in a refined way to the selfishness that's all around us, albeit with a gloss of Buddhism over it. I suspect that here in Cambridge, it's probably not quite like that in London, partly because until recently you've had Windhorse trading, and you've had a lot of people in the Sangha here working in a way that is for something larger than themselves. So perhaps I'm talking from a London-centric perspective, where most people come along because they want a better life. And as I say, I don't want to knock that. I'm just saying that it's not enough. Not enough for us to be doing that. And it is a danger, a real danger in Western Buddhism. I think it's a real danger in Sri Ratna. As we grow older, and as we sort of become a bigger, more established movement, that we just settle into comfortable lives. I can feel it in myself. I hope I don't. I'll probably need my friends, Ratna Gosha and others, to stop me, because left to my own devices, anyway, I won't go there. So, if we're going to do that, if we're going to be working on our own minds, and we're going to be trying to be together as a Sangha, a force for good in the world, resistances will arise. It's not just me and my laziness that I'm not alone, I'm sure, in that. Resistances will arise, although they'll be different for each of us. And the Dharma life can be like a battle. It doesn't have to always be like a battle. It can also be like a love affair. But tonight it's a Motor City and it's going to be a battle. The Dharma life can feel like a battle at times. In a particular form of a Motor City, he carries a flaming sword. He wields this flaming sword. In the more common form, it's the Vishvavajra, and I'll come on to that. But in this battle, if we're going to actually overcome or even start to deal with our self-centeredness, our deep, deep, deep-rooted self-centeredness, we will need some energy and determination and courage. Without that, actually, we're not going to get very far. We won't get very far, even with the help of our Sangha friends. That's partly because we're not integrated. And again, I speak for myself, not fully integrated. A Motor City is, in so many ways, a symbol for what integration truly, true integration, would look like. The Vishvavajra that he carries, maybe I'll come on to that later on, is a symbol of integration at its highest, an overcoming of all duality, self, other, samsara, nirvana. It's a symbol of true, true integration. But actually, before we get to the Vishvavajra, a Motor City's throne, his lotus throne, is carried by Shangshang birds. Have you heard of Shangshang birds? Shangshang birds are these mythical creatures who are half human and half bird, eagle-like birds with wings and claws and talons and then human bodies. They're sort of, I feel a symbol for our own unintegrated kind of natures. We're half human, half beast in a certain sense, aren't we? Sort of fallen angel, risen ape. It's a little bit like what we're... The human condition is like that, the unenlightened human condition. It's not just that trying to be derogatory. It's just that is the unenlightened human condition. And the Shangshan bird is a sort of positive symbol for that in the process of integration. And they carry a Motor City, that duality in the process of a Motor City, of integration. They carry a Motor City's throne, and they're bashing these symbols as the throne flies through the air in the night sky. They're sort of clamoring. It's not a peaceful entrance. It's a dramatic, sort of wild entrance. And of course, his right hand is in the Abhaya Mudra, which is the gesture of fearlessness, supreme fearlessness. And the fearlessness of a Motor City, the gift of that fearlessness is a transcendental quality. It's not just courage. It is the fearlessness of a consciousness that has no sense of separate selfhood, no sense of selfhood as separate from the rest of, not just even life, but all of reality. If there was no sense of separation, there is nothing to fear. There is no outside to threaten the inside, because those mean nothing, ultimately. And in our unenlightened state, of course, when we're going to experience fear at times, there will be fear. Again, just going back to the Paris atrocities, I was moved by, probably in a way, what I appreciated reading the most was the acts of heroism. And they're still sort of coming out, people who were incredibly courageous. You know, a man who lay on top of his girlfriend to protect her, and he took a bullet, or another man who went towards the gunman to try and shield somebody else, and he died, or somebody else who seems to have you know, there's this pregnant woman hanging from a ledge outside the concert hall, and he pulled her up. She was hanging on for dear life, and would have died if she'd fallen, and he hauled her up and hid her. Or a man that I read about who was in working in one of the restaurants, and he there were two women on the terrace outside who were injured, and he went out and dragged them in and then took them to the basement and hid with them, and they all survived. And every instinct in him, well, if I imagine, would have been to run to the basement myself, if you said I mean. But no, he looked outside, went out to the terrace where there were gunmen, and managed to drag these two women in. There's extraordinary feats of courage, of heroism. I don't know what I'd be like in that scenario. I really can't say that I would, you know, I would be able to do that. I don't know. So there are incredible courageous acts happening probably all the time that don't make, as I say, the headlines. But we, as Dharma practitioners, will need to develop all the courage that we can if we're going to live a truly radical life. Because the world around us won't celebrate our going forth from comfort and the conventional worldly life. It won't celebrate that. We're not going to make the headlines for those acts of courage, but they are acts of courage. We will need to keep making them. I like to think that, oh, I've done that. I've done my going forth. When I was in my late 20s, early 30s, I left my career. I left, you know, moved into a community. I'm still living there, and I'm working for Tree Ratna. And I suddenly kind of realise, oh dear, I've got more, much more to do. I'm really quite comfortable in my situation. Yes, it's going to keep demanding courage, in a sense. And Amoghur City's, in a way, his gift to us is, well, the inspiration to do that, to keep challenging the world around us, to do the uncomfortable thing. Now, before I read this, so I just want to say one more thing about commitment. I was talking to Ratna Ghosha, we were talking just earlier in the evening, and he was remarking that, well, in his view, there's a lot of people who are now coming to the LBC, a lot of people. The centre's very, it's very exciting, actually. A lot of people are coming. And yet, not that many of them, proportionately, are asking for ordination and joining the order. Not that many proportionately. And I don't know all the reasons why that is. It might be something that we're not doing quite right. It might be that the centre's so big that it's hard to give individuals enough Kalyana Mitrata. But I think there's something else that's going on, in my view, which is that we live in a culture where commitment is a taboo. It's sort of not even taboo, actually. It's just seen as completely unnecessary to live a happy, healthy life. You can do exactly what you like, have everything you need, and now you can have Buddhism on top as a little bit of sort of sauce on the side that makes you a bit more interesting at parties. You can do all of that and be a thoroughly sort of decent person. Why would you want to commit? At least that's the sort of zeitgeist that I can come across. But without commitment, probably all of you here kind of know this, or most of you know this, without commitment, real transformation doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. And at some point or other, the Dharma life runs out on us if we're not committed. If we're not committed, it sort of stops working. Yeah. I'm not to read you a poem of D.H. Lawrence's, which is... Well, when I read it, it reminded me of something of Omega City. What it speaks to me of is that as well as this force of inertia, there is around us a force that's asking us to grow, to go beyond ourselves. We sort of feel it in our sort of quieter moments, perhaps in our dreams, perhaps in our solitude. We feel this urge to move towards something bigger, to grow. We feel this urge for meaning. All of us do. And one way of talking about Omega City is that he's calling us, he's always calling us to move beyond the comfortable, the known, to go out into the forest, to go out into the night, to have the courage to stand there alone, let the wind blow, and let these kind of mysterious lights dance around us. And to see what the unknown brings. Let me read this poem. It's called Song of a Man Who Has Come Through. And hopefully you'll see the resonance. Not I, but the wind that blows through me. A fine wind is blowing the new direction of time. If only I let it bear me, carry me. If only it carry me. If only I am keen and hard like a sheer tip of a wedge driven by invisible blows, the rock will split. We shall come at the wonder. We shall find the Hesperides. Who is the knocking? What is the knocking at the door in the night? It is someone wants to do us harm? No. It is the three strange angels. Admit them. That's wonderful, isn't it? Who is this knocking in the night? Is it someone wants to do us harm? No, it is the three strange angels. Admit them. And you can hear that call if you listen. If you listen, it's there for everybody. But I do think that we can be deafened by the noise of the world. To this silent, sort of strange but very quiet knocking of life that tells us to live more. So in a way, this brings me to the sort of second and final part of my talk, where I want to say this poem sort of starts to touch on, in a way, the mysterious force that can break through if we allow it to. And that force is a force of transcendence. And it's more than just being a good human being. So far, what I've been talking about has been primarily about the karma, the law of karma, the karma niyama, which is, again, what Omega City is associated with, karma. But all our ethical strivings, all of our working on our minds, in a sense, it's not enough. It's not enough just to be a decent human being, although what a wonderful thing that would be too. The Shangshang birds aren't the ultimate symbol of integration. There's more. And the more comes through us, when we see the delusion, the root delusion of a self that exists as separate from the world. Actually, it's even that's not enough. We have to not only see that there's no such thing as a real and separate fixed me, we have to see that there's no real and fixed separate anything. Not others, not things, not the world around us, not our notions of space and time, none of it is what we think it is. None of it is what we think it is. Sometimes the Dharma is talked about, the conditioned existence is talked about as a dream. It's talked about as a dream. And in a way, that's a very good analogy. But the dream includes us as the dreamer. We're in it. We're completely in it. It's almost like a sealed system. We each of us are dreaming this dream, but we're also dreaming ourselves. So it's not that we stand outside the dream having the dream, and the dream is unreal, but somehow we're real. The dream is also me and you dreaming the dream. It is part of the dream. The whole thing, the whole show, the whole shebang is mind-made. Buddhism says it's mind-made. Not your mind, not my mind. Mind-made. And we don't know what mind is, because mind isn't a thing either. The whole thing, yeah, the whole thing. We're sleepwalking through this almost sealed system. It's not quite sealed. Amoghta Siddhi's light, his wind, his call, is breaking through. The enlightened mind is always breaking through. It's breaking through because, in a way, conditioned existence isn't really separate from the enlightened mind. Maybe I'll come on to that. But anyway, it's breaking through. It's breaking through all the time, if we let it. My own experience is that if I resist this call, this knocking on the door, and I do try and resist, if I resist, life gives me a bit of a shake until I sort of cooperate again. These days, at the moment, anyway, I tend to resist less, and then life sort of works out. But ultimately, I know life won't work out, and I'll need to have the courage and the faith that actually it's all right to completely let go of this illusion of me and this illusion of the world as out there, as separate. And to the degree that we can let go, because it's not a black and white thing. Sometimes I think, even in our order, we start to talk of insight as if it were a sort of black and white thing. You know, 1 minute you've got it or haven't got it, and then you have, and then it's sort of saved. We're saved, which feels, I don't know, it just feels daft as well as deluded. It's not a black and white thing. It is a progressive thing of waking up, letting go, however you want to call it. But to the degree that we do that, something wonderful happens. Our minds do experience a fulfillment, an expansiveness, a sense of love and connection that is completely sort of enough in its own right. I mean, it's worth everything. It's worth everything. That fulfillment is worth everything. Now, of course, for most of us, we don't seem to live in that expansive realm. But it is pointing to what's possible for each of us. And this journey, this progressive journey of ever more letting go of me and this delusion of me and world, probably doesn't end. Bhante talks of enlightenment not as an end point, but as the furthest point on a horizon beyond which we can't see. And Amoghta Siddhi is actually just beyond that horizon point. Just beyond the horizon point. So his compassionate activity stems from a realization a mind that has no no boundaries, no artificial boundaries between self and world. And yet, there's something about Amoghur City. He feels to me like, I don't know if this is traditional, but he feels to me like the culmination of at least the four outer Buddhas of the Mandala. And that's because not only does he represent the enlightened mind having transcended all delusions and limitations, but he's the enlightened mind then coming back into samsaric conditioned existence and being active in it as a force for good. That is compassionate activity. The dualism then between samsara and nirvana, conditioned existence and the unconditioned, is seen as itself a limited view. It's deluded. In Amoghur City, there's no distinction made. This conditioned realm, this dream realm, it's just left behind. He's then an active agent playing in the dream. And perhaps from the enlightened mind's perspective, this conditioned realm becomes a realm of magic, of wonder. It isn't just this world of pain and suffering and dissatisfaction. Avatamsaka Sutra and the White End School talked about, there's the image of Indra's net, isn't there? Do you all know of Indra's net? This net of jewels, where it's an image for reality itself as this infinite net of jewels, and each jewel in this net is not only sparkling and beautiful and glistening of itself, but it's reflecting within it all the other jewels. Maybe conditioned existence from the enlightened mind's perspective is like that. That's maybe what it's like. Maybe that's not too fanciful. I can remember asking Bhante once, I was fortunate enough to be studying with him when I was still a Mitra convener, and anyway, I was taking him his lunch or tea or something, and I said I could, I started talking about Lalakshanas and said that I could sort of sometimes see more nakedly, more truly, what impermanence and insubstantiality and things meant. But what about this teaching that all things interpenetrated all things? What on earth was going on there? You know, this magical teaching. It somehow fascinates me because, maybe that's another story, but ever since I was a kid, I've had this image, which I sort of have later come to interpret as Indra's net, of these points of light in a dark sky. Somehow, they're moving, they're on a grid, they're different colours, they're tiny, tiny points of light, and they seem like jewels. And for me, it's an image of Indra's net, in a certain sense. So I've had this image since I was a boy. Anyway, I said, what about this teaching, Bhante? Because I was talking to Sagramati, and he was saying, well, it's just rubbish, all of that. You don't want to believe that, son. And so I said, what about this sort of mutual interpenetration of all phenomena? I didn't say what about. I think I was more respectful than that. I can't quite remember how I phrased it. And Bhante, I think I said, how do I reflect on it? How does one realise that? And he just looked at me. He probably couldn't see me. Although he once said to me, we were sort of sitting opposite on a long table, and I said, he'd recently lost his sight. This is another digression. He'd recently lost his sight, and I was opposite him on this long table, and I said, Bhante, how well can you see? Can you see anything? He said, I can see your ears. Which was always it's tickled me off. Anyway, so I said to him, how does one approach and reflect on this? And he just looked at me and he didn't answer. He just said, yes, all things contain all things. All things contain all things. And I just felt this thrill sort of go through me as if I'd been given, well, you know, a sort of like a Zen master had hit me on the head. So Amoda City, to go back to Amoda City, maybe that's how the enlightened mind experiences what we call conditioned existence. And if all things contain all things, and he can dance in this net of mutual interpenetration, then in a way he's a master of action. Compassionate action is not just what we think of, because we think of it in this world of self and other. But there's something much, much more indescribable going on in every phenomenon. If every phenomenon does contain the whole cosmos, if every grain of sand, if every glass of water is the whole thing, and Amoda City, the force of compassionate action in the world, can manipulate, play with that, there's a complete dance, isn't there, and freedom and play. His I don't know what it means. I don't know what it means. So that's where real fearlessness would arise from. There would be no fear. There'd be nothing to fear. For us, though, I guess, all we can do is work on our self-centeredness as we do. But also, I think we need to be working to see through this delusion of separateness and then open up to what lies beyond. That's another thing, actually, that I'm sometimes struck by. In our order, there are lots and lots of people who are saying that they have seen through, to some degree, the illusion of a fixed and separate self. And that's fantastic. That's fantastic to the degree that it's true, as it were. And who am I to say, as it were? But what I would say is that it can't just be about, oh yes, I don't really exist, and now I'll get on with my life as normal. If this realization has really penetrated, it would be like we would be living in a world of wonder. Yeah, there would be a sense of infinite number of jewels interpenetrating each other, in me, in you, in everything. There would just be a dance and laughter and release and love and gratitude overflowing. Now, of course, we're all at different stages of that, so maybe that will arise. I hope it does. But let's not kid ourselves that we're somewhere further along the path than we are. There's something really magical that the Dharma's pointing to. Beyond just getting on with our lives. And of course, if we think that we've arrived and then we just settle down into our comfortable lives, my fear is we're blocking the possibility of these wonders opening up. Ante seems to be in touch with something, doesn't he? Even now when you see him, that isn't of this world. It really isn't. And yet, he's in this world and he's created our world. So I want to just wrap up now. Maybe I haven't really talked too much about the Vishvavajra, but maybe you can start to see something of its significance of all dualities being fully, fully united and integrated. And the Vajra, of course, is said to be it's a diamond thunderbolt. I like to think of it as the most powerful force of nature contained in one form, and the Vishravajra is the Vajra, as it were, squared into unimaginable power that a modicity just wields and he just holds in his hand. But the duality goes beyond that, doesn't it? It is, I think, conditioned existence and the unconditioned, to use that metaphor. It's samsara and nirvana completely integrated. It's this dreamlike world and whatever absolute reality is seen as non-different and just held in his hand. But I want to finish with a sort of warning to all of us, to not forget the glimpses of this transcendence that we've had, and we all must have had some sort of glimpse to be able to be here, to be practicing at all. We must have at some point heard the knock on the door of these three angels. So this is a sort of urge, warning to not forget that, yet to not settle down, to have the courage to keep moving forward until we do, for ourselves, know the mind that Amoghacitti is a personification of. So this is something that David Foster Wallace said and wrote. David Foster Wallace was an American writer, a novelist. He died tragically. He died young. Tragically, he took his own life. He suffered for a long, long time from depression and battled against it, and eventually took his own life. And he was one of the most sort of promising up and coming writers of his generation. And he was giving the piece I'm going to read is an address that he was giving to some American university students on the day of their graduation, some Ivy League university. They're about to enter into the adult world, having lived in this very, very privileged, probably very privileged, sort of devaloka for a number of years. And he's sort of meant to be giving an address that congratulates them on their achievements and tells them how they can go and conquer the world, and you know, these are the future leaders of America, the businesses, etc., etc. And instead he says this, and it's quite a long passage. I'll read it quite slowly and then finish with that. Because here's something else that's true. In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshipping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of spiritual thing to worship, be it Jesus or Allah, be it Yahweh or the Wiccan Mother Goddess, or the Four Noble Truths, or some infrangible set of ethical principles, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap into meaning in real life, then you will never have enough, never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly, and when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. On one level, we all know this stuff already. It's been codified as myths, proverbs, cliches, bromides, epigrams, parables, the skeleton of every great story. The trick is keeping the truth up front in daily consciousness. Worship power, you will feel weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to keep that fear at bay. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out, and so on. Look, the insidious thing about these forms of worship is not that they're evil or sinful, it is that they are unconscious. They are default settings. They're the kind of worship you gradually slip into day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value, without ever being fully aware that that's what you're doing. And the world will not discourage you from operating on your default settings. Because the world of men and money and power hums along quite nicely on the fuel of fear and contempt and frustration and craving and the worship of self. Our own present culture has harnessed these forces in ways that have yielded extraordinary wealth and comfort and personal freedom. The freedom to be lords of our own tiny skull-sized kingdoms, alone at the centre of all creation. This kind of freedom has much to recommend it, but of course there are all different kinds of freedom, and the kind that is most precious you will not hear much talked about in the great outside world of winning and achieving and displaying. The really important kind of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline and effort and being able to truly care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over in myriad petty little unsexy ways every day. That is real freedom. The alternative is unconsciousness, the default setting, the rat race, the constant gnawing sense of having had and lost some infinite thing. Thank you.